Thank you very much. Well, what I'm going to be speaking about this afternoon is the impact of circadian rhythms on sleep, and in particular, the effect of light on resetting circadian rhythms. To set this in perspective, it's important to understand that in the human system, if we schedule individuals to sleep at all different phases of the 24-hour day, and we accomplish this by scheduling people to sleep either on day lengths that are far longer or far shorter than 24 hours. So in order to avoid having them synchronize to the day length that we're imposing, we have to be outside the range of entrainment of the circadian system. In this particular case, individuals are scheduled to be on a 28-hour day, which would be the equivalent of flying westward across four time zones every day for a month. Some of you peripatetic scholars may have attempted this protocol as you circumnavigate the Earth, but here we have people living in place in the laboratory where they're shielded from periodic changes in the outside world, no clocks, no radios, no information sources as to the time of day, but plenty of interaction with the staff who are coming in and out of the study throughout the time that they're there during wakefulness. And when we record sleep, in these individuals, and I guess here, when we record sleep in the individuals, and here we reference all of the data in the upper panel with respect to the phase of the endogenous circadian rhythm of melatonin secretion. We have melatonin samples being collected every hour throughout the month. We have an indwelling line that's about 12 feet long that extends outside of the room during sleep so that we can collect samples even when the individual is asleep. And there is a very robust circadian rhythm of melatonin secretion, so that even when we have them on a 20-hour day or an 11-hour day or a 28-hour day or a 42.85-hour day or whatever crazy day length that we to which they're scheduled, we can the endogenous circadian rhythm of melatonin continues to oscillate with a near 24-hour period. And so we can assess using mathematical procedures the period of that circadian melatonin rhythm, and then we can plot the waveform of that profile, and we set the middle of the peak of the melatonin rhythm to a phase angle of 0 degrees, and then the rest of the 360 degrees are expressed here. And what you see is that if we look at wakefulness during the sleep episodes that are then scheduled to be evenly distributed across all circadian phases, you can see that the probability of being asleep varies with the phase of the melatonin rhythm. We can also use other endogenous circadian rhythms as a marker for the output of the circadian pacemaker, such as the circadian variation of body temperature or the circadian rhythm of plasma cortisol. You see here that when individuals are scheduled to sleep at during the equivalent of the biological day, So this dotted line would be approximately 4 a.m. in an individual who slept from midnight to 8 a.m. on a regular basis, because usually the peak of the melatonin rhythm occurs in the middle of the habitual dark time of the 24-hour day. Although, as you'll see later, that there are inter-individual variations in that. But on the average, this would be the equivalent of 4 o'clock in the morning, and that's why we've written in the corresponding time of day up here, 4 a.m. So here you see that at the habitual bedtime, ironically, the percentage of wakefulness during the scheduled sleep episode is very close to its highest level of the day. And that's why we call this a paradoxical timing of the circadian system, because the peak of the circadian variation in the propensity to be awake from the point of view of the output of the circadian pacemaker occurs a couple of hours before we habitually go to sleep at night. Whereas the peak of the circadian propensity to sleep occurs a couple of hours before we wake up in the morning. Now you might think that this has been designed by some sinister individual who was trying to promote the pharmaceutical industry on the one hand for tablets for insomnia at night, and the Starbucks industry for having people run out to get caffeine at wake time. But actually, we have come to think that this paradoxical timing. And in fact, when Bill DeMent and Mary Carr Skadden first scheduled individuals to live on a 90-minute day, and they scheduled their sleep to be 30 minutes out of every 90 minutes, and their wakefulness to be 60 minutes out of every 90 minutes, and they found that the college students were able to sleep with the highest proportion of time in the between 9 and 10 o'clock in the evening, excuse me, between 9 and 10 o'clock in the morning, and they were able to remain most, they could only sleep about 10 minutes out of every available hour from 9 to 10 in the evening. They originally thought that maybe this was just because they were college students and they were shifted, and maybe at Stanford they were staying up till the wee hours of the morning or something like that. But in fact, in studies where we have looked at a whole variety of different protocols and made sure that the individuals in these studies for 3 weeks prior to their entry in the laboratory had been on a regular schedule, going to bed at a specific time and waking up at a specific time with an 8-hour interval for 3 weeks before the start of each study, as verified by actigraphy and logs and telephone logs calling in and so on at their bedtimes and wake times, we still see this same relationship. And so we've come to think about this, and it is consistent with the work of Dale Edgar in The Squirrel Monkey as well, that the circadian system is, the timing of the output of the circadian system is set up to oppose what would otherwise be an increasing drive for sleep with each passing hour of wakefulness. We are unlike most mammals in that we don't take cat naps and rat naps throughout the day. Alan Pack was just saying a few minutes ago that each species has a different amount of time that they can sustain wakefulness. And for most of the other mammals, they can only sustain wakefulness for a short period of time. As homeostatic sleep drive builds up, they need to sleep. And our homeostatic sleep drive is also building up throughout the waking day. But the circadian system gives us a second wind in the latter half of the day. Now, I'm hoping that I'm not scheduled to talk. I'm after the nap phase. So in the middle of the, some of the other speakers earlier today were trying to speak right during the phase when the circadian system has not yet come to the rescue, but considerable homeostatic sleep drive has built up. And then we might have seen some slow rolling eye movements in the audience, because there is a phase in the middle of the day. It's been called a postprandial dip in alertness and performance, but it actually occurs even if you don't eat lunch. And I think that it represents a gap between, the first half of the day, we've just awoken during the night, homeostatic sleep drive should be much lower once we've gotten past the sleep inertia of the first couple of hours of wakefulness. Then we get to that nap phase where the beautiful data were generated from those naps that were given in terms of learning and memory. But after that, the circadian system makes it progressively more difficult to nap as the afternoon and evening wear on. And so that latter part of the day we actually call a wake maintenance zone. And so it's actually hard to catch up on sleep by going to bed a few hours earlier. And many people, in terms of the workforce, are experiencing longer commute times and earlier start times. In fact, the Bureau of Labor Statistics has indicated that the period of time before 5 a.m. is the time when the greatest increase in the number of people working is in terms of the starting hours in the United States. And so as those early morning wake times are required for the early morning work times, people still have difficulty then going to bed earlier, because their sleep latency is greatest near the time of their habitual bedtime, particularly a couple of hours before their habitual bedtime. So ironically, people are saying, they've been exhausted all day because they only slept 5 or 6 hours during the night. And so they're thinking about going to bed early, but they're just going to go check their email before going to bed. And then suddenly they get into this phase where the circadian system is sending out this tremendous drive for wakefulness to help sustain our alertness in the latter part of the day and help us to maintain this consolidated bout of wakefulness. And then pretty soon, 3-4 hours have gone by, and they're going to get another 4 or 5 hours of sleep that night because they have to get up early in the morning. Now, the circadian system also sends out a tremendously strong drive for sleep that peaks at about 1 to 2 hours before our habitual wake time. And the circadian pacemaker is located, there are about 50,000 neurons on either side of the third ventricle in the anterior region of the hypothalamus, just above the optic chiasm. And this pseudocolor image is actually represents melatonin receptors on the cells in the SCN. Now, when I say that this is the site of the human circadian pacemaker, that is not to say that other cells and other organs in the body don't have all of the molecular clockworks necessary to drive circadian rhythms. And in fact, it's been known since the 1970s from the work of Andrews that if you take the adrenal gland and put it into culture and give it a constant infusion of ACTH, it will produce rhythmic circadian variations in the output of cortisol. But the suprachiasmatic nucleus acts as a master circadian pacemaker, conveying temporal information, and it is synchronized. The output of that pacemaker is synchronized by the light-dark cycle from a direct retinohypothalamic tract that innervates the SCN from the retina in the eye. And so you have environmental input coming to synchronize this endogenous circadian oscillator. That signal that's coming to drive the circadian system is allowing us our circadian system to be reset by photic input that is coming through the retina. And here you can see in experiments that we've done in which we've given a single pulse of a little over 6.5 hours of light. And the light intensity is about the level of light intensity that you would experience just before dawn, or just after dawn, or just before dusk outside. And one single exposure can reset your circadian system either to a later hour, if you get that exposure just before your habitual bedtime, and the blue box here represents the habitual bedtime hours, and the if you get that same stimulus near your habitual, just after your habitual awake time, that light exposure will reset you to an earlier hour. So if you were, for example, to fly to London, and you take one of those typical overnight flights that gets you to London at the equivalent of midnight your time, but the equivalent of 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning London time, then if you go outside and you are exposed to light at that particular phase of the circadian system, you're going to be reset toward in the direction of Hawaii rather than being reset in the direction of your desired adaptation to London. So the timing of your exposure to light is critical in terms of the resetting response. Now that has implications for individuals attempting to work at night and sleep during the daytime, and we have been able to do studies in which we have shown that properly timed exposure to bright light at night and darkness during day sleep is very effective at resetting the circadian system. And since we originally published this study, we've actually done specific trials in which we looked at either bright light at night with no control of light exposure during the day, where it's ad lib for when they slept during the daytime, or scheduled exposure to darkness during the day and no bright light during the nighttime. Or just the control condition in which they're in ordinary room light at night and ad lib sleep during the daytime. In that typical condition, there isn't much adaptation even after a week of working at night. And in fact, there have been cases demonstrating that even permanent night shift workers working this kind of schedule for years never really adjust their circadian system, although some individuals do, but many do not, the majority do not. Whereas if you're exposed to properly timed exposure of bright light at night and darkness during their day sleep, and these contribute approximately equally to the response, with regularity in the day sleep being critical to the resetting response, then within a couple of days, you can be fully reset so that your body temperature is low during the daytime and high at night. That is associated with an improvement in alertness during the nighttime hours and in cognitive performance during the nighttime hours, and a shift of all the circadian rhythms of that we measured in terms of urine production, plasma, cortisol, body temperature, and so on. And a very consistent response across subjects that was associated with a two-hour improvement in the amount of sleep that these simulated night shift workers got each night. Now, when we began studying totally blind individuals, we were surprised to find that while some totally blind individuals maintained free-running circadian rhythms that were not synchronized to the 24-hour day, which you might expect if you had no light input to the circadian system, then the subject's internal circadian rhythms would oscillate at the intrinsic period of the oscillator. What we were surprised to find was that there were some individuals who were totally blind, no conscious light perception, who were entrained to the 24-hour day. And we found that a subset of these individuals actually continued to have photic input that was synchronizing, that was suppressing the release of the light-sensitive hormone melatonin and was entraining their circadian rhythms, and their endogenous circadian rhythms could be reset by light that they couldn't see. Once we got this published 5 years after we actually first made the observation, and there's a very distinguished list of journals that rejected this paper on the theory that, first of all, these people must have been able to see, and we just didn't, they weren't telling us that they could see. They didn't realize that they were not totally blind, notwithstanding evaluations by neuro-ophthalmologists at the Massachusetts Eye and Ear Infirmary and whatnot. And the other hypothesis was that, we mixed up the blood samples, and this wasn't actually melatonin suppression and various other explanations. But once we had gathered enough cases, and then they made us do experiments in which we covered up their eyes to verify that when their eyes were covered, they did not have any suppression of melatonin, but when their eyes were exposed to light, they did have suppression of melatonin. And fortunately, Russell Foster was concurrently having a whole series of papers rejected in mice, retinally degenerate mice, who he was showing their circadian system could be reset, even though he had demonstrated in behavioral experiments that they also were totally blind and would be shocked by light that they had been trained to avoid with the foot shocks demonstrating their blindness. And he was also getting those papers rejected. And finally, we both were able to get them into the literature, which we were excited to more recently, in about 5-6 years after those publications, it was recognized that there is a subset of intrinsically photosensitive ganglion cells that are not the classical rods and cones, and that were mediating circadian photoreception. And so, and Josh Gooley, who was on a graduate rotation in Cliff Saper's lab, and Cliff has said that he's the only graduate student who on a 6-week rotation ended up with a paper published in Nature Neuroscience, but he demonstrated that those intrinsically photosensitive ganglion cells contained melanopsin. A very elegant set of studies that Dr. Burson at Brown has done has shown that those melanopsin-containing retinal ganglion cells are directly connected to the suprachiasmatic nucleus of the hypothalamus, and when he gives a light pulse, those cells respond. But interestingly enough, this is 10 minutes on this scale here. Unlike the classical visual photoreceptors, the rods and cones, which are activated on a millisecond time scale and shut off as soon as the light shuts off, here you can see that it takes minutes for the response to end and minutes for the response to start up. So this is really more like a photometer. These melanopsin-containing cells have a different spectral tuning in terms of their peak sensitivity to light. A number of labs did studies using melatonin suppression to find out which this was both at the University of Surrey and then in Bud Brainerd's lab at Thomas Jefferson University, And then we collaborated with Bud and brought his light cannon, as he calls it, in which we were able to give monochromatic exposure to either blue light or green light. And the peak of photopic sensitivity function for the conscious visual system is at 555 nanometers. But the hypothesized peak sensitivity of this melanopsin system in these intrinsically photosensitive ganglion cells, and by the way, remember, ganglion cells are not supposed to be, they're just supposed to be the messengers carrying the information from the rods and cones. They're not supposed to be any card-carrying photoreceptors, which was why this was so shocking. But when we stimulate and when we then evaluated phase-shifting responses, we found that the phase-resetting response to the monochromatic blue light was twice as great as the phase-resetting response to the monochromatic green light, to which the photopic system is most sensitive. And so photon per photon, when we had the equal photon density, we found that one way of simply expressing this is photon per photon looking up at the blue sky gives twice the resetting effect on the circadian system as looking down at the green grass. So our system, the spectral tuning of the system responsible for mediating circadian photoreception, is quite different than that for mediating conscious visual responses. Then we also have to realize that there is a nonlinear variation in the impact of light exposure in terms of its resetting effect with the intensity of the light. So if we look at the response to 10,000 lux of white light here, and we reduce the light intensity from 10,000 lux to 100 lux, which is only 1% of the light exposure, we still get 50% of the resetting response. So, as Dan Kripke showed here in San Diego many years ago, we don't get much exposure during the daytime to very bright light, but we have lots of exposure to artificial indoor room light. And so you might think, well, unless you're in really bright light, you're not going to be having much of an impact on the circadian system. And in experiments that were done in Germany many years ago, it was concluded that unless the light were over 1,500 lux, it didn't have any impact on the circadian system. Well, that turns out to be an artifact of the way those experiments were carried out, in which subjects had free availability of indoor artificial room light whenever they wished to turn it on and off in the facility. But when we do the experiments and control for all of the retinal light exposure, we find that even candlelight exerts a resetting effect on the circadian system. And that certainly ordinary room light of 100 to 150 lux of light, which we're in for many, many hours during the day, has a profound impact on our circadian system. And in fact, when we were studying those blind subjects, we had one of the blind individuals who, when he was a freshman in college and we studied him, his peak of melatonin secretion was 4 o'clock in the morning, like all the college students we study, in the middle of his scheduled dark episode. But when we studied him a couple of years later as an upperclassman, this individual who had no conscious light perception, his peak of melatonin secretion at that point was at midnight. And I asked him, what was different between, of course, he didn't know the results of the study. What was different between that? Nothing, he told me. And I said, anything change in your living environment? No. He said, well, the only thing is, now that I'm an upperclassman, I have my own room, whereas when I was a freshman, I lived with other roommates. And I said, well, when you lived with the other roommates, what did they do in terms of when they turned on and off the lights? And he said, well, when I lived with the other roommates, they had the lights on, whenever they had. He said, I don't know when they had them on, but, I presume that they were on during the daytime. And I said, when do you turn on and off the lights? And he looked at me as if I were a moron. And I was immediately, when I say he looked at me, I mean he turned toward me. Because he was astounded that I asked him that. He said, why would I turn on the lights? And I said, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to. And I said, well, if your friends come over or whatever, he said, I don't even have any lights in my room. And he said, the university's too cheap to provide any, so I'm not about to go out and get a lamp. And I said, well, what if somebody comes over? And he said, well, that's their problem, isn't it? And I said, what about the shades on your room? And he said, on your windows. And he said, well, there are windows right next to my bed. I don't have any shades because I don't need shades. So he was actually living in what is, and then I was reminded that midnight, there's a reason that it's called midnight, and that's because it's actually the middle of the light-dark cycle in the outside world. You know, most college students, they look at midnight and they're thinking, maybe I should think, you know, at Harvard, they're now serving a midnight meal. Because so many students are awake, they're not going to bed until 3, 4, or 5 o'clock in the morning, so they need another meal at that point. they practically eliminated breakfast from the whole program. So midnight is not even viewed as the middle of the night. It's viewed as maybe it's time to think about beginning your homework if you're a college student. But I was reminded when I saw his data that midnight is actually the middle of when the light-dark cycle is in the outside world, and if he weren't using artificial light. So I began to realize that our whole society, Edison may have shifted our whole society westward by a significant amount, but we're still trying to get up at the same time. And I think that's one of the reasons that is putting pressure on our sleep to decrease the time that's available for sleep, because that wake maintenance zone from the circadian system is pushing us to a later hour if we're resetting it by artificial light in the evening. And then we're truncating our sleep with the alarm clocks. Now, we've already talked about the endogenous rhythm of melatonin. And here you can see the profound relationship to sleep efficiency, that when subjects are scheduled to sleep at all different circadian phases, when they're sleeping at the phase of when melatonin is being released, which you can see with these horizontal lines here, the sleep episodes are uniformly consolidated, whereas when they're trying to sleep out of phase, many of the sleep episodes have a great deal of wakefulness, which is shown with these black bars here. So one of the things we were able to do is to determine the intrinsic period through this protocol of the output of the circadian pacemaker. And we find that unlike what was reported previously, because from many of those cave studies, it was reported that we had a period of 25 hours and that some people had 30, 40, 50-hour periods and that some people had 16-hour periods. And we were thought to be different than all other species who have a very tight clustering of their periods around a particular value. But when we actually study them and control the light exposure and put them on this particular protocol in which we can use melatonin as a means of assessing the period of the circadian system, it turns out that humans are very much like other cockroaches and other species in terms of the average period and the range of variability across individuals. And we have an average period that is about 24 hours and 9 minutes, plus or minus a minute or two, and we have a standard deviation of about 9 minutes. We have a range from about 23 and a half hours, we now have some individuals over here, all the way up to, in some individuals, within the sighted population, of about 24.5 to 24.75. Now, in blind people, the periods are somewhat longer than this, averaging about 24.5 hours or even longer. And it may be that there are after effects. What we're now learning is that there are, it just as has been reported in other species, there are after effects of prior exposure to light. Also, when the studies are done in blind people, they eliminate all those who are, quote-unquote, entrained to the 24-hour day, who are within 24 hours plus or minus. And it may be that those who are closer to 24 hours become entrained by non-photic synchronizers, because we think that the non-photic synchronizers, like exercise and activity and sleep itself, can capture within plus or minus maybe a quarter of an hour if your period is close enough to 24 hours. So if you're hovering right in here around 24 hours, and if you lose your sight, both your conscious vision and the intrinsically photosensitive ganglion cells, then you can probably be captured here. But if you have a 24 and a half hour period or whatever, you're not going to be captured if you're blind. Interestingly enough, we did a study that originated here in San Diego. The only time we've ever studied subjects who we were not allowed to know where they were, and it was with the Naval program. They were on the nuclear submarines, and they were living on that 18-hour watch schedule, which is very similar to our 30-hour, 11-hour, or 20-hour days. And we wondered if they were exhibiting non-entrained circadian rhythms as they were circumnavigating the world. And so we got them to measure their melatonin in saliva, and we captured them at 6-week intervals during the cruise, And then we assayed all the samples when they got back, and sure enough, we found that on average, they were precessing in about a 24.3-hour period. Now, I'll just close with the fact that, you know, you might say, well, what's the difference if my period is shorter than 24 hours or 24 hours or a little longer than 24 hours? And the main impact is on the phase angle of entrainment. It turns out that that there is a beautiful relationship, and when we use melatonin, it gets even tighter. It goes up to about 0.95 correlation between the period of the circadian system and the phase angle of your entrainment to the 24-hour day. What does that mean? That means that if you are have a short period, then you get to the same point of your circadian system, the rising phase of the melatonin rhythm, 4 or 5 hours before someone who has a longer period. And this is well known in all species when you compare their period to the phase angle of entrainment. But we didn't think that in humans living in an environment in which they're getting sporadic light exposure, I mean, the pioneering data that Dan Kripke collected indicated that there's tremendous inter-individual differences in exactly when they're being exposed to light. So we didn't think that there would be a relationship. But if we look at them on the first day that they arrive, there's a beautiful relationship between their period and their that we determine in the subsequent month, and the phase angle of entrainment when they arrive. And we also find that this is related to their responses as to whether they're a morning person or an evening person. What probably holds true is that the person who begins to release their melatonin 5 hours before their habitual bedtime, they're going to be much more tired in the evening. And they're going to be the early morning types, because when they wake up in the morning, at 7 o'clock in the morning, or let's say 6 o'clock in the morning, that may be 11 a.m. for them, biological time. Whereas when another person wakes up at that same hour at 6 o'clock in the morning, but they haven't begun to release their melatonin until 2 hours after their habitual bedtime, because they have a long period, those individuals, for them, when they wake up at 6 o'clock in the morning, it's equivalent to 2 o'clock in the morning, biological time. So ironically, those evening types who are always criticized for waking up late, they are actually waking at an earlier biological time than the morning types. And with that, I'll close. Thank you.